Are vegans actually unhealthy?
Does cannabis ruin your sleep?
And why are so many men taking testosterone supplements? I'm Mitch.
And I'm Greg.
And we're the creators of the popular YouTube channel ASAP Science.
Every week on our podcast Side Note by ASAP Science, we explain the science behind a controversial subject with recent research, up-to-date studies, and ridiculous stories so you are entertained while, bam, simultaneously learning.
We're here to make science make sense.
Download Side Note by ASAP Science wherever you get your podcasts.
This is one of those bonus big stories over the holidays when we talk about emotions and human relationships and seeing the world through someone else's eyes. I like to think that I'm empathetic. And unless you're a jerk or exceptionally self-aware, you probably think you're empathetic too. But where do we learn empathy? How do we acquire it at a young age? What sorts of experiences and feelings are needed to make sure that that skill grows up with us and allows us to mentally walk in someone else's shoes? One thing that can help is understanding the experiences of our parents and how they navigate the world. And when the world that your parents are navigating is strange and sometimes hostile to them, while you come to internalize a sort of empathy that isn't as readily available to kids who grew up with almost everything. And as the numbers now have it, there are soon going to be more adults who have grown up with that empathetic experience than ever before. So what happens to us and to Canada when the second generation brings their unique brand of empathy into adulthood? I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. This is a bonus episode of The Big Story. Sadia Ansari is a freelance Canadian journalist. She's currently working in Berlin, and she wrote the piece that we're discussing today as part of a fascinating series for a Refinery 29 project called Second Gen. Hello, Sadia.
Hi, Jordan. How are you?
I'm doing as well as can be expected, which is my pat phrase for this entire year. How are you?
That's a good one. I might steal it. I'm good. Yeah. I would say I can't complain, but I definitely can, but I won't.
Fair enough. Why don't we start this discussion? Because I honestly had not thought of the scope of this cohort. Can you give me a sense of how large the second gen population is in Canada?
Yeah. So from the last census, which was 2016, so I mean, we'll have better numbers soon. We know that there are 6 million second-gen Canadians, and 37% of those under 15 were second-gen in 2016. So that's a really large number. So I think it's really going to change our country in, you know, increasingly profound ways.
And maybe quickly, just because we're going to use this term a lot, can you explain, for census purposes at least, what does it mean to be second-gen?
Sure. So actually, a lot of people get really confused about this. So first generation, some people think first generation is like if you're born in Canada, you're first gen, but you're actually second generation. So if you immigrate to Canada, you're first generation Canadian. And then if you're born in Canada, you're second generation Canadian. And then there's kind of like this in-between generation, which is 1.5. So like, for instance, I'm actually 1.5 gen. Which I wrote this whole piece about being second gen, and I realized I'm actually 1.5. So 1.5 means you weren't born in Canada, but you were essentially raised in Canada. So in my case, I was born in Karachi, but my parents were Canadian. My older sister was born in Canada, and then we moved back to Canada when I was about 2 years old. So I like had a second gen experience, but from like a counting point of view, I don't think I would be counted as second gen.
For those of us who haven't experienced it firsthand, or even maybe haven't had, you know, a really close friend or relative that's grown up that way, can you just maybe give me a sense of some of the experiences that second-gen kids are likely to have as they grow up? I know you describe a few in your piece.
Yeah, so I think, I mean, it's really dependent on who your parents are, right? So it's very dependent on race and class and other factors. And I think I can kind of speak to my own experience and, you know, the generation that I'm in. So I'm in my mid-30s. My parents are a little bit older than most people's parents around me, for instance. So I think that also impacted my experience in terms of when they came over. My dad came over in his late 20s, and my mom came over in her mid-20s. And the experience for me, you know, growing up with my parents, and then they had me a little bit later. So my mom had me when she was like 33, and my dad was like in his early 40s. So for me, there's also a generational gap between me and my parents a little bit, especially with my dad. And that kind of factors into cultural things, but maybe not everybody necessarily has that kind of gap. But I think some of the things you experience are just seeing your parents treated differently than you. And I think that's the thing as a child, you become very acutely aware of that. You know, for instance, we're talking about race a lot, and that definitely factors into a lot of these kinds of conversations. But for instance, I think like having an accent is something we don't always talk about. And you can see when you have an accent and when you don't have an accent, the difference. And when I say don't have an accent, I mean, don't have a Canadian accent. This is a very,
right.
So even in the way I speak about it, it's very biased, right? So my parents, you know, don't have a Canadian accent, and you can immediately see how someone will treat them differently than someone with a Canadian accent. And I think that like, as a child, there's also the embarrassment related to that, right? Like you're embarrassed that your parents have an accent. You're embarrassed that, you know, if my mom ran out in, you know, desi clothes to get something from the grocery store, that would embarrass me because it was just like this marker of difference. So I think there's all these markers of difference, and you kind of immediately absorb how the world around you treats you as a result of those markers of difference, if that makes sense.
It does. I mean, I don't have that experience unless you count my father being a dedicated hippie folk singer and just looking weird to all the other kids at school. But it's not the same thing. What goes through your head when you're a young child and, you know, you start to realize those things? Like, do you remember when you began to realize that your parents spoke with an accent that you didn't have or wore different clothes than your friends' parents? And how do you work with that in your head? How do you process that experience?
Well, it's funny because I grew up in Markham, Ontario, which is actually the most diverse place in Canada.
Right.
So for me, most of my friends' parents were actually from either a similar background or just like also an immigrant background, like the vast majority of them. So, but it was still in a way, it wasn't like the difference between my parents and my friends' parents. It was more like my parents and what I saw on like Saved by the Bell,
right,
or whatever,
yeah.
Right? It's like this like idea of what's normal. And I think we all can kind of relate to that, like the idea of what's normal on TV versus what's like happening in your own life or what someone looks like in a magazine and what's happening in real life. And I think when you're second gen, it's just sort of amplified in a bit of a different way because there's more of a cultural, you know, disconnect. And so I never noticed my parents had a different accent than me, for instance. I think it was just something like that was just the truth, you know, it's just something I grew up with and it felt very normal to me, but I can see how it factored into how people treated them. So, you know, in the piece that I wrote for Refinery 29, I talk about this one instance, which just seems really small, but I never forgot it. You know, my mom had taken me and my sister on the bus to this really sort of 1970s era mall that's like very industrial looking, single story, you know, I'm sure you can imagine it in a Toronto suburb. We went to like the Sears outlet there or something like that, because my mom would go buy stuff on sale. So also like my family grew up, I would say like, you know, middle class, lower middle class. Like I didn't feel like I grew up without money, but certainly there were these small things where like, you know, we're not going to the bay in the mall to go shopping, right? We're going to like the discount, whatever. And so, you know, it's like quite, you know, it's like a 45-minute bus ride. We go do the shopping. My mom is like, okay, I'm going to buy you guys, you know, a pop. You can just sort of enjoy it before we leave as our little treat. And we're in this food court and, you know, she picks up these two Cokes and we never drank pop. We never had pop at home. So it was like really exciting. And, you know, we sit down and like a minute after we sit down, this sort of like middle-aged white guy who obviously managed, this restaurant in the food court came at us and started yelling at us to leave because we hadn't ordered anything. And so what we didn't realize when we sat down, I was quite young. I was like maybe 6 or 7 years old. My sister was maybe like 11 or 12. And, what we didn't realize, my mom didn't realize, was that like it's one of those weird food court restaurants, right? Like, you know, sometimes there's like white booths and it belongs to like a little outpost of some food court restaurant. It's just like a stupid thing where you just sit in the wrong seat,
right,
or whatever. But the way he yelled at us was just like so shocking and embarrassing. And my mom is like a pretty slight person. She's with two kids. She has a bunch of shopping bags. You can sort of imagine it. And I think for someone to come at her and yell at her in that manner, it was just the feeling that I had was just like embarrassment, right? Like we did something wrong. That was the feeling. And before we left, I remember she said this to both of us, and I'll never forget it, was, you know, don't ever tell anyone that happened, because it felt like we were getting kicked out of somewhere, mm-hmm. you know? And she didn't do anything wrong. She made a mistake. But what I noticed is, like, upon reflecting on it as an adult, I didn't realize it at the time. When those things happened when I was a child, I was just embarrassed and I thought we were always wrong. Like, we must have made a mistake. And so what I realized reflecting on it as an adult was just that, you know, this man thought he could treat my mother like that. I don't know who treats people like that, but people obviously do. And we see it all the time, right? So it's like, it's people making a split second decision, looking at someone, how they're dressed, the color of their skin, like just deciding, like, how can I treat this person? And I think those were the small moments where I realized people, even between me and my parents, people think they can treat us differently, right? So certainly I have people mistreat me as a journalist. You know, if I'm trying to get access to someone, quote unquote, powerful, like I do notice sometimes people have more of an issue.
Yeah.
Where they ask way more questions than they would some of my colleagues, right? Like those kinds of things, right? But with my parents, I noticed there's like a whole extra layer of that.
Well, and this is why I want to get into what you wrote about and what you called the superpower of kids who grew up second gen. And I feel like I'm the perfect person to ask you about this because I am a straight, white, middle-aged man in heterosexual relationship in Toronto. And so what do moments like that that you described that I didn't experience growing up, what does that teach you, and what do you have from that now that you can use in your life?
I think it's interesting because I think in those moments, what I felt was shame. And I think it's because you kind of, as a child, are made aware of like this kind of social hierarchy and where your standing is on it, right? Based on how people treat you. And so you kind of see that and you're like, okay, my social hierarchy is like here. My parents are somewhere here because, you know, they have an accent and they have this, that, and the other. And they're very aware of mm-hmm. it too, right? So my parents would say like, you're Canadian. You have a Canadian accent. You went to Canadian schools. Like, you know, they're in their opinion, they're like, you can do anything. You can be prime minister. They're still waiting for me to start my political career, which I'm like, yeah, 100% not going to happen. But, you know, like they have these ideas right. about the advantage it gives me, but that I didn't see as a child. I was like, I don't get what you're talking about. But now I totally understand. It's like they saw the difference between their experience and what my experience would be immediately. Right. And so I think that's kind of what it gives you. It just gives you this understanding that people are going to treat you differently. They're going to look at you and make a split second decision based on like, how powerful are you? What can you do for me? Or what can you do to me if I mistreat you? Right. And often that was kind of like a losing situation for my parents. And so you see that. And I think it just really makes you very, very aware of how someone sizes you up immediately, if that makes any sense.
It does. And where does that lead to empathy and the advantage that that can give you when reading a room, I guess, or interacting with people in situations like you've described?
Yeah. So, I mean, Brené Brown, who's a very famous empathy researcher, you know, she talks about it as like, it gives you a set of bifocals. So if you grow up inside the mainstream culture, which in Canada, you know, what we consider mainstream, or when I was growing up, you know, it's Zach Morris, right? It's like a straight white guy who, you know, was wealthy enough to have like one of the first cell phones on earth in like 1992 or whatever, you know? And so if the world is built for that lens, then you never really need to look outside that lens, right? Because no one's making you uncomfortable, or you don't feel like an outsider because the world is kind of built for you, right? But if that world is not built for you, then you're constantly looking at like, okay, this is what's like quote unquote normal, and this is what I am, and this is how I have to twist myself into a pretzel to make myself this thing. The thing that you notice is that, oh, it's not just me who's doing that, it's a bunch of other people who are doing that, right? And so I think that like, I can't understand someone's experience who's totally different from me, but for instance, living inside two cultures and just seeing my parents being treated a particular way, just seeing all these different things, it kind of cultivates this feeling inside of you of just being able to see like, oh, life must be hard for you because X, Y, Z, mm-hmm. right? And, or, you know, like people might treat you this way because X, Y, Z. Or if you're at the grocery store and someone's struggling, you know, to speak English or whatever, you can help them. You know, someone else might just like walk by, not because they're crappy people, but because they're just not noticing. It just makes you notice different things. And then as a result, I think, you know, empathy is kind of defined as feeling with someone, not like feeling for someone or, you know, making it about your feelings, but just saying like, oh, like this thing you're experiencing is hard and like I see it.
I'm Laura Palmer, host of Island Crime. Season 6, Sweethearts, is the story of three teenage girls who were all murdered in Victoria, Canada, within about 12 months.
So she was scared. Something out there scared her.
You just created the playground where predators can really thrive.
She was a 16-year-old girl. She was a sweetheart.
Listen to Sweethearts at frequencypodcastnetwork.com or wherever you get podcasts.
Find your frequency.
What do we know about empathetic people and how empathy helps us? There have been studies on this.
So there's tons of studies on empathy that show it makes you a better partner. It makes you a better manager at work. It makes, you know, STEM education more meaningful for kids, for them to understand how to like apply certain concepts. And, you know, in medicine, it's actually huge. And, you know, I wrote a piece like a few years ago on empathy in medicine and the lack of empathy in medicine. And empathy is really seen as like the art part of medicine. So if medicine is an art and a science, empathy has a lot to do with the art. And unfortunately, we've kind of gone the other way in medicine where the science is really valued. And so people are doing 20 tests on your body when you say you have shoulder pain and nobody touches your shoulder and says like, how are you managing that? You know, and those like small things that just when someone sees you as a human being, you know, and you're relieved. And I think we've all had that experience at a doctor's office where you feel like they're not seeing you and they're not hearing you, you know, and they're not really trying to understand what you're feeling. They're just trying to like solve this, you know, puzzle that's kind of divorced from you as like a human being. So I think that there's tons of different, you know, I think like the academic literature is really clear that empathy is pretty much, you know, good for society. Also as a whole, there was a book also written about, you know, how we need empathy. It's called Humanity on a Tightrope and written by Paul Ehrlich and Robert Ornstein. And, you know, the book is about how we need to see each other as family, because if we see each other as family, maybe we're more likely to exercise empathy and we can come together to address, you know, the greatest threats to humanity, which are war, climate change, pandemics, you know, because those are really large issues where it's really hard to care unless you can imagine how it's going to impact, you know, people who care about you.
Well, that's kind of the last thing that I wanted to talk to you about is this has been obviously a really shitty year and it's not over yet. And we're heading into a holiday season that I think for some people, it is usually a really happy time and is now probably going to be a really, really tough time. And what can we all do, even those of us who maybe don't have the experiences that make us, you know, naturally and genuinely empathetic, what can we all do to try to practice this when I guess we need it more than ever?
I think during the holidays, emotions always run really, really high. And I think right now with COVID and, you know, just in order, like you can't see people. So that's really hard. Or people are going to be asked to see each other and asked to make decisions about that. And those decisions are going to be really hard to make. And then with, you know, the holidays, if you celebrate Christmas, that's can be, you know, a really lovely time, but also a financial burden. And I think this year is a year where maybe a lot of people have, you know, maybe not lost their jobs, but lost work or, you know, were out of work for a number of months. And maybe it's just like, also not the time to feel like we're celebrating. It's been a, you know, a really, really hard year. And I think that one thing that I listened to a podcast early on in the pandemic and, you know, said something to the effect of like, if you imagine that everybody is like trying their best, it actually makes you sort of a lot more empathetic because you're like, if you're trying your best, if someone's being shitty to you and you're like, wow, they're really trying their best and that's as far as their best is going to take them, they must be having a really hard time. It's just a bit of a mind shift because, like, everyone, I think when emotions are high, it's really easy to get upset at people or take things personally. And then if you take a step back and just say, like, I don't even know what they're going through. It could be so many different things. And I don't need to take this personally. I can, you know, you don't need to take on everybody's stuff during the holidays because I don't think any of us will survive that. Just like understanding that everyone's having a hard time and like not everyone's going to have a perfect reaction. Not everyone is going to be doing well at this time. And so I think it's just taking a step back to say like, okay, this is not the time that everyone's going to be on their best behavior and that's okay.
The last question I want to ask you is hopefully going to end this on a more positive note. When you think of that huge cohort of second generation kids that you mentioned at the beginning of this conversation and the empathy that they have and the experiences that they have making up such a large chunk of the future of Canada, you know, what kind of impacts do you think that will have on the country?
I think it can change our country in profound ways, but I also think that you can have access to, like, you know, the bifocals analogy is great. You can have access to this extra lens, and whether or not you exercise that or put on those bifocals is a totally different thing, right? Mm-hmm. But I think, for instance, that, you know, I do think that, like, empathy is the gateway to solidarity. And I think that's, like, kind of where you find political change. So I think it's not just personalizing it to be like, you know, COVID is happening and I should wear a mask, otherwise someone's grandmother will die. You know, it's just really having a broader sense of like, I don't have to imagine that it's my friend's grandmother who might die. I just have to like understand that every single life is valuable. Like, I think those are the things that we just kind of need to extend, you know, that kind of individual empathy into more of a solidarity to kind of create more structural change. And we look at policing, for instance, right? Like, we know, for instance, that there's major harm that comes to the Black community and the Indigenous community in Canada at the hands of the police, unfortunately. And, you know, I'm not part of one of those communities, but I can see it.
Yeah.
and I can exercise whatever small power that I have to, you know, lend my voice or lend whatever that I can to sort of move towards some sort of structural change. So I think that it's just about like building bridges and building coalitions. And I don't know, I don't know that I can say second generation are just so much more likely to do that because it's so dependent on individuals, but you know, I would hope so.
I hope so too. It would be nice to see that kind of change. Thank you, Sadia, for walking us through this and sharing a little bit of your experience.
Thanks for having me on.
Sadia Ansari, a freelance Canadian journalist over in Berlin. That was The Big Story. For more, head to thebigstorypodcast.ca. You know this by now. Find us on Twitter at TheBigStoryFPN. Write to us at TheBigStoryPodcast, that's all one word, all lowercase, at rci.rogers.com. And if you are still feeling holiday generous, head to your favorite podcast player. Find us, rate us, review us, recommend us to a friend. We always appreciate it. We'll be back January 4th with fresh big stories every day. Until then, thank you for listening. I'm Jordan Heath Rawlings. We'll talk in the new year.
In 2007, TV network CBS dropped 40 kids in the middle of the New Mexico desert as part of a brand new reality show. These kids would have to build their own society from scratch. And if this sounds like Lord of the Flies to you, well, it was meant to.
We were on this mission together. We were going to prove to the world that we could make a better society than adults could.
I'm Josh Gwynn, and I want to know what this wild TV experiment was really about. Split Screen, Kid Nation, a 6-part podcast from CBC. Available now.